Okay, it's my task to introduce this course, which is really going to be given by three people. By myself, I should say, firstly by Rabbi Cardozo, by Rabbi Alon Goshen Gottstein, who was his first year with us last year, and we're very pleased that he's coming back to help us teach this course. And lastly, by myself as well. The course, Explorations in Halachic Thought, might have some people wondering what it's about. Some people might wonder why there's a need to explore. Others might be wondering, what does halacha have to do with thought? Unfortunately, that's a combination of words that appears far too infrequently. Before I'm going to explain what we're going to be doing, the truth is I'm not going to be doing a lot of that, rather just to give you a thumbnail sketch, to give you an idea of what it's about. I think it's appropriate to explain why we're doing this class, what it is that we're trying to accomplish, and why we feel it's appropriate to study the intellectual contours, the shape of halakha, and what can be done with them, with the contours. First of all, I think it's not a difficult contention to make that halakha is at the center of Jewish culture, certainly religious Jewish culture. All you have to do is open your email spoofs. I don't know, I'm sure you've all gotten various spoofs on different things that we don't associate with halakha, such as the halachot of Christmas trees. I don't know if you got that one, how short it can be, how tall it must be, that must come from natural fibers. Or the halachas of making beds, the halachot of all sorts of things are passed on the email. And the reason it's funny is that normal people don't do halacha. When I say normal people, obviously that's in quotes. In Western culture, in Christian culture, certainly in secular culture, the idea of looking to the details of one's daily behavior and analyzing different acts that are otherwise mundane, such as eating or putting on one's shoes and looking at the exact detail of how to do this in the best possible way, sounds to most people as something that's somewhat strange. And therefore, when you take this out of context and put into something where it's not usually done, then it's funny. I mean, granted, this would not always be true in all cultures. In Islam, for example, there is a similar sense of oral law, if you will, of religious law that does go into the details of people's lives. From the little I know about Islam, I don't think it compares to halakha in its sense of the rigor and sense of study that is involved in trying to find out the minutiae of exactly what to do, as well as its mass knowledge that the average Muslim would know his particular religious tradition in terms of what to do at all sorts of different places in the same way as the Jew knows. Not that they're ignorant of it, but they're simply less to know. Again, this is from an outsider's perspective. But be that as it may, even if Islam has as developed, were it to be the case that Islam has as developed a system of halakha, if you will, ultimately that comes from an older tradition, Islam basing itself on the Jewish tradition, imitating on some level that which already existed. Now, there's certainly what to critique about halakha. And for better or worse, we've gotten a reputation as an institution that does a lot of criticism. We critique a lot of different things. We're not afraid to look carefully at our own tradition, our own sources, and point out the problems. And the famous line they say in Yeshivot, Man Shtart Nifon Akasha, which, if you excuse my Yiddish, as a Sephardi, it's not so good. Translation for the other Sephardim in the class is that a person doesn't die from a question. Even though that's said in Yeshivot, I don't know how, to what extent it's believed and practiced in Yeshivot. We really believe that to be the case. And we're not afraid to ask questions and be critical of our own tradition. By the same token, as an introductory class, I think it's very important to explain why we're defending the halachic system to begin with. In other words, much of the class is going from the assumption that halacha as a system is somewhat broken, is in need of fixing. Now, when you have something broken, you have two options. One is to fix it, and the other, to get rid of it. And the question we must ask ourselves is why it is that we have our loyalty to halacha, that we feel if it's broken, and again, I'll explain why I'm saying that later in the class, but if we feel that it's broken, why not just trade it in for a newer model? Right? Why is it that we feel we have a need to work with it and somehow make it work? Granted, I think everyone in this class is coming with a certain level of commitment, and on some level the Torah requires that we follow the halakha. But be that as it may, as I've argued in different places, the fact that we follow halakha, at least if we're thinking people, comes more because we approve of halakha, we approve of its merits, we see importance in the system much more than out of a sense of obligation. For were we to see that halakha is counterproductive, there are certainly ways to get out of it. I'm not even speaking about rebelling or trying to transform the system in non-orthodox, so to speak, ways. There are traditional methods such as Horat Sha'ah, Et La'asot La'Hashem, and I'm not going to speak about whether these particular methods are operative because it's not really the point. The point is that if we saw that halakha was counterproductive, then I'm sure that we would be able to find ways to abort the system. Now, it's important that I explain my terms here. When I speak about the halakhic system, I like to call it the halakhic enterprise. And what I'm not speaking about is Torah law, is the essential doraita, the essential laws, the backbone of halakha, which comes from the Torah. But rather the developed rabbinic process that evolved and expanded the halakha to what it is today, which far, far exceeds in multiplicative ways what was originally mandated in the Torah. On a practical level, if we think about our days, even Shabbat, there are very few things that we do that are commanded in the Torah. If you think about it, certainly on a weekday, a man puts on tefillin. It's pretty much the only situation that you encounter that's clearly mina Torah. A person could eat, right? Birkat Hamazon is likely from the Torah, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Kriyat Shema, there's not a lot. We could probably fulfill all of our obligations in the course of 3 minutes. Practice is not that way. We're constantly involved in tefillot, in brachot, in Talmud Torah, in all sorts of other intricate laws that come into our lives on a daily basis. And certainly when you speak about Shabbat and Yom Tov and Kashrut, the same is true. Very few people are aware that most of the issues that we come across are not really biblical in origin. Most of the halachot that we come in on Shabbat to keep Shabbat on a doraita level is not very difficult. But if you want to keep the halacha as we have it today, as it's been developed by the rabbis, well, then you need at least a Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, which is 600 pages and running. It keeps on expanding every time you check. It's not easy. And I would argue that this development of halakha from this very unintrusive biblical skeleton to the rabbinic enlargement and intensification and concern about detail, I would argue, is not something that was unplanned. That as I use the term enterprise, it means something that was started with intention, that the rabbis had a specific idea in mind. There is a Gemara in Shabbat on Daf Kuf Chaf Gimel Amud Bet, it's 123b, that speaks about different historical versions of the Muktzeh laws, Muktzeh, what you're able to move on Shabbat and what you're not able to move on Shabbat. And the Gemara over there goes through different historical changes, saying that at one point in time, the laws of Muktzeh were so severe that there was almost nothing that a person could carry. And the rabbi is trying to figure out, well, when was that period? When were those laws so severe? And they try to identify it with the period when the Jews came back to Eretz Yisrael before the Second Temple was built. Those of you who are familiar with the books of Nehemiah, Ezra and Nehemiah, know that the situation was very problematic. That Jewish identity was at an all-time low. As bad as we think things are today, if you look what's going on over there, it's probably even worse. In any case, the rabbis say at that point in time, when Jewish identity was so much in question, there was a need to make more restriction. And as things got a little bit better, the rabbis were able to ease off on some of the restrictions. But what the rabbis did by doing this is to create extra consciousness. Each time a person was forbidden from lifting something that they otherwise would be allowed to lift, they would have a consciousness that there's something going on here. And I would argue that this model, this Gemara, serves as the essential model of what the rabbis were trying to do from that time, from the time that rabbinic law had its origin, sometime around, people speak about Ezra and the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, whatever the time period is, some point during the Second Temple period, the rabbis, consciously or unconsciously, came up with the idea that there's a need to bring more contact between the individual Jew and holy behavior. More contact to stop and to make people think about what they were doing, about the world around them, and about who they were. And we suggest that that's at the root of the halachic enterprise. But that's my theory. And it's not really important, again, whether you agree or disagree with this. Consciously or unconsciously, whether the rabbis had this in mind or not, the halachic system has had a tremendous impact on Jewish life as we know it. And I want to speak about two of the most important facets, two of the most important components of that impact, the impact of halacha. First one, I hinted to it already a couple minutes ago, is our relationship, the relationship of the average individual Jew with spirituality and ethics. Now, a lot of the things that I'm going to be saying may be obvious to some of you, many of you. I think the formulation is important, and I think it's important that advanced students sometimes review the basics. I think it's important for people who have knowledge to understand the basics, because otherwise the basics stay basic. What I mean by that is it stays simple-minded. I've built much of my career on teaching Chumash in an advanced level, because people more talented than I don't want to go back to what's basic, so they don't teach it or look into it and leave the field open. The basics of the Jewish religion is something that we take too much for granted. So even if this is obvious to you, I think it's important to rethink it, to appreciate the formulation, or not to appreciate it, but to put our attention, at least for this class, into what is the halachic system all about. Again, the first level of impact on the micro level, on the level of the individual Jew, which accomplishes something on the macro level in terms of the Jewish community, in terms of Jewish history, is the relationship that it creates between the individual Jew, on the one hand, and spirituality and ethics, on the other. Again, I'm not an expert in all cultures, all religions. I don't know how many people are able to say that they are. But I think, from my limited knowledge, that one could make a case, highly probable case, that the average Jew historically was more in touch with the values and ideas of his tradition than average people in just about any other major religious tradition. I'm not talking about saints. Those of you who were here with us last year, we examined some of the Christian saints. And every religion has outstanding people who we as intellectually honest people should admire and look into their lives. But I'm talking on the average level. We call in yeshiva terms the balabas, right? The person who works for a living, right? This is true now. This is certainly more so the case 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, was more connected to the values and to the ideas that were at the center of the Jewish tradition. And certainly there were other factors that had an impact on this besides halakha. For example, the pariah status of the Jewish people, the fact that they were isolated and forced on some level in many historical periods and places to stick together, the literacy level of Jews, the fact that they had easier access to their tradition because they could read what their tradition said, and they were encouraged to read what their tradition said. But I think the most important component of why Jews had more connection to the ideas and values of the Jewish tradition is because halakha literally put it in their face. That a person could not ignore, even for an hour, anybody who took the Jewish tradition seriously and felt that he had to make brachot when he ate. And a person eats many times a day. Had to be confronted with God, with Yisrael, with all sorts of concepts that surround the halakha. Such that halakha provides constant and intrusive contact points between the individual and spirituality. And I would also point out, if you've not noticed it already, that most of rabbinic halakha, I'm not talking about what makes up most of the books, because if you look in the book, there's a giant book that no one ever looks at, called Choshen Mishpat. Right? And there are a variety of reasons for that. But one of the reasons is we don't deal with any of the things talked about, at least most of us, on a daily basis. If you sell a house, you buy and sell, but other than simple buying and selling, which in any case, Choshen Mishpat is on some level sidetracked, there's not a lot that concerns us. What does concern us much more is the book of Orach Chaim. And this is what we study. This is the fair of study when we study halakha. By and large, I would say the 90 to 95% of halakha that study has to do with Orach Chaim. And if you look at Orach Chaim, there's very little about what you do ben adam lechavero. And I think there's a point in that. In other words, the idea of ethics is obviously something that Torah, the biblical law, is very concerned with. But the halachic enterprise is to create consciousness of spirituality. And consciousness of spirituality means being aware of God. As a result, most of daily halakha has nothing to do with shaking your friend's hand. It has to do with blessing, it has to do with Shabbat observance, it has to do with Yom Tov observance, it has to do with prayer. There's an interesting article which speaks about this. It's not a great article, but I think it makes the point well. From the late Professor Ze'ev Falk, used to be the rector of the Conservative Seminary here in Yerushalayim. He passed away. Article called Spirituality and Jewish Law. There's nothing offensive in the article, even for someone who doesn't like the conservative movement, where he speaks about the connection, which should be obvious, between halakha and religious values. There's a parallel article, if anybody's interested, in the same book. The book's called Religion and Law. It's a parallel article about Islamic law and spirituality, so you can get a parallel fare on that, but doesn't go into much detail. In any case, the way that halakha is concerned, not just with doing certain things, with minutiae, but the best way of doing the minutiae, what we call the idea of the lechatchila, is also something that I think is not coincidental. Again, if not consciously, then unconsciously. The idea that you're not just supposed to do the act, kedei letzeit yedei chova, that there is a lechatchila way of doing things, that a person can keep kashrut a certain way, and there's a better way to keep kashrut, an even better way to keep kashrut, which some people think might have gotten out of hand in our day. I don't know how many of you have seen, there are different wrappers that have five different hashkachot, the little piece of gum, right? You have five, they don't even have enough wrapper to put all the hashkachot in. But be that as it may, the idea of lechatchila, which is grounded in the halachic tradition of not just how to do it, but the best way to do it, is something that encourages a certain type of consciousness towards God. And I would suggest simulates an emotive connection. When doing something for God, it would make sense that you would want to do it in the best possible way. Not simply, today let's say, Tidei Chova. And the fact that we're doing it that way, I would suggest, if we pay attention to what we're doing, should help us understand that it's God who we're dealing with. Put it a different way. There's presidential elections in the United States today. When a person goes to visit the president, you put on your best suit. If you have 10 suits, you're not going to wear the worst one because of the honor of the office, because you want to make a good impression. There is study in how you dress when you go in front of the president. Granted, it's unconscious, or it's certainly not formalized. There's no Shulchan Aruch. Again, there's no halakhot of going to the president. But the underlying idea is there. The idea of being concerned to appear in the best possible way because your interlocutor is someone of great importance is something that permeates the halachic system in the idea of lechatchila. To put it a different way, halacha creates the relationship not only of respect and awareness of importance, but it creates an emotive relationship of love that can only be compared to that between lovers. And that association is something that's not original. Obviously, Shir HaShirim is not even the only place in Jewish tradition, the biblical tradition, where the comparison between Klal Yisrael and God on the one hand, and a man and woman on the other are made. I would suggest the halachic process, by requiring us to try to pay attention to every detail, reinforces that idea. But a person knows that if you really love someone, especially in that type of a relationship, you try to pay attention to every detail. To try to do things in such a way that every detail is pleasing to the one you love. And you think about what you wear, and you think about how you say things, and so on and so forth. And I would suggest that the halakha, by paying attention to minute details, is trying to simulate that relationship. Again, to create a consciousness, on the one hand, of importance, and on the other, of emotional love. That's one point of impact. Creating consciousness for the individual Jew of ethics and of spirituality. The second point, and the point that's more basic, is the survival of the Jewish people. That is to say, halacha has given us the cohesiveness, the idea that we need to stay together to perform the halacha, and a distinct identity that's created through the halacha. These issues have allowed us, I would say, to survive in exile for thousands of years. And again, there are certainly many variables that are allowed for our survival. But in the center of our culture, and I think a tremendous factor in our survival, is that very halakha. As an example, the so-called Moranos, right, the Jews who were asked to convert, not asked really, they were told to convert in Christian Spain, right, Torquemada and the like, who had the Inquisition wanted Jews to convert or die. Some left, others, though not many, died, and others converted. Of those that converted, many decided they still wanted to be Jews. Now this was very difficult, because being a Jew, they realized, meant keeping halacha. It's impossible, classically, to be a Jew in your heart. A Jew has to act. Halacha forces us to act and maintains our distinct identity, so that Morano Jews had to put their life on their line in order to be Jews. There was no choice. There was no way to hide one's religion in one's heart. We studied several years ago Locke, who speaks about how ultimately faith is in one's heart and one's mind, that may be true of the Protestant tradition that he was a member of. It's not really true of classical Judaism. And for that matter, even the Moranos, despite the compromise that they made, maintained their traditions for hundreds of years. Eventually, most of them assimilated. But the fact that they kept it for as long as they did has, I would say, very, very much to do with the halachic enterprise. And it's in this vein that the famous secular Zionist leader, Ahad Ha'am, said the following words, words that are well known. He said, those of you, most of you I'm sure are familiar with Ahad Ha'am, was a Baal Machloket of Herzl, a different idea of what Zionism should be about, someone with a religious upbringing, but ultimately went away from, certainly from Orthodox tradition. He said, Yoter ma'asher Am Yisrael shama et ha-Shabbat, ha-Shabbat shamra al Am Yisrael. Now I say this in Hebrew because it doesn't work in English. Right? The word shamar is a key term. In English, it will be translated as more than the Jewish people have kept the Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. Okay, maybe. It's not as good. In any case, the idea being guarded was what I would have to use, would work better. But it also is not ideal. In any case, Ahad Ha'am, coming from a secular perspective, at the time he said this, and he spoke about Jewish tradition as a whole in very similar fashion, that the preservative, the way the Jews survived in exile for so many years, was because halacha forced them to survive. That is to say, it's a distinct group, there's a distinct unit. You couldn't simply be like everybody else and still be Jewish. You had to make a choice. Of course, for some Zionist thinkers, this was only necessary as long as the Jews were in exile, as long as there was a need for a national preservative. in artificial situation. It's not normal for a nation to be in exile at all, but certainly for 2,000 years. And therefore, there was a need for extraordinary measures in order to keep the Jews as a people. But that claim itself, that this was only necessary so long as the Jews were without a nation state, is in fact highly contestable. I know Rabbi Cardozo has addressed this issue on many occasions. In fact, if you read his new book, I think there are many essays that deal with this issue of whether, in fact, the Jewish state of Israel can really survive without any attachment to the Jewish tradition. He's speaking on a physical level. But even were we to grant that Israel could survive on the physical level without attachment to the halachic system, I would suggest that what we'd be left with is nothing like the Jewish people we really know. Meaning the Jewish people whose genius has been celebrated for centuries throughout the world and serves as, if not the central focus, and perhaps it is the central focus of Western civilization, which is a dominant civilization in our world. Certainly one of the two or three major foci of Western tradition, where Western tradition looks for its seminal values. The people of these values, even if they could survive physically, would be no more kindred to the classical Jewish people than contemporary Greece is to ancient Greece. And anybody who knows anything about modern Greece and ancient Greece will realize that the fact that the Olympics were held in Athens recently does not mean much. But I think one can go beyond Echad Ha'am. After all, Echad Ha'am was coming ultimately from a secular perspective, and go to our own roots, to the imagery that Rabbi Akiva portrayed so forcefully, and I would suggest study of Rabbi Akiva's life as a whole. I once wrote about Rabbi Akiva as the quintessential Jew. He's our national hero, in the same way as Wilhelm Tell is the hero of Switzerland, or Jeanne d'Arc is the hero of France. And the quintessential hero, the person who represents Jewish heroism more than anyone else, and we have many heroes, is Rabbi Akiva. And there's much to say about Rabbi Akiva, and perhaps on another occasion we'll delve more deeply into his life and teachings and his important contributions to Jewish tradition. But in any case, we're all familiar, I would imagine, with the story of Rabbi Akiva explaining why he had to study Torah when the Romans had outlawed it upon penalty of death. He told people, it's like a fish being out of water. For a Jew not to study Torah is impossible. And the illusion is as beautiful as it is appropriate in terms of understanding the role of halakha in our national survival. It's not a question, I think, as Echad Ha'am presented, that merely preserves us until we're able to live like normal people. It's sort of an oxygen tank that we need so long as we're sick. But once we get healthy, you get off the oxygen tank. Rabbi Akiva suggesting that no, it's not the tank, it's the air we breathe. Or, as the mashal, it's the water that the fish require. Now, when Rabbi Akiva spoke about study of Torah, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Rabbi Akiva and his teachings and the like. One of the things that Rabbi Akiva was told by his colleagues is to stop getting involved in Agadata. Right? They say, Malach Akiva etzel Agadata. Whenever he tried to get involved, they said, what do you know about Agadata? You don't know anything. And this is Rabbi Akiva, the Gadol Ador, the greatest of his generation. Right? Why that is not really important right now. My only point is that Rabbi Akiva was a halachist par excellence. And when he studied Torah, when he spoke about studying Torah, he was not talking about Parshanut. He's not talking about reading my book or going to Rabbi Grumman's class. He was talking about studying Halakha and expanding, which Rabbi Akiva does in many occasions, upon the corpus of what a Jew has to do, and finding the best way of how to do that. And Rabbi Akiva said, this is the water of the Jewish fish. This is the air we breathe. Without the development of this process, without its study, without keeping it, without preserving it, there will be no Jewish people. Simply put, true Jewish survival is dependent, I would say, on the halachic enterprise. By the way, it's survival, which otherwise is extremely difficult to explain away. The famous expression that Arnold Toynbee spoke about the Jews as a fossil. A fossil meaning something prehistoric that one would not think should be around today. And yet you find it. That expression, which was viewed with tremendous animosity by the Jews, on some level has some truth. And it's been echoed by others as well. I remember reading in more than one recent article by different people comparing the existence of Jews, living next to Jews, who keep the halakha, as something akin to living next to Edomites. What are they doing in our world? They shouldn't have, according to historical principles, they should have died out a long time ago, like the Edomites did and everyone else. And so therefore, halakha, this unique feature of Jewish culture, may in fact be that unique spice that serves as a preservative for the Jewish people, at least according to Echad HaAm, and according to Rabbi Akiva, serves as much more than that. So the halakha has served us well, has allowed us to survive. And not only to survive, but to flourish and to be a nation that's great and that's admired and that produces tremendous creativity, both within the Jewish tradition and those Jews who started or had roots in the Jewish tradition and went outside of it also show tremendous creativity, which no doubt has its roots in their cultural heritage. When we look at groups that have abandoned, on some level, the halakha in modern society, we feel that we're further justified. We see, whether it be a religious group such as Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism, whether it be secular movements such as secular Zionism, Bund Socialism, all these groups have not been very successful on a sociological level. And so therefore we can bring greater ammunition to our argument, and so, I think to a fault, have Orthodox Jews done in the past. With a sense of triumphalism, we told you so, if you'd only listen to us, we'd be in much better shape, all you had to do is listen to the halakha. But as I said at the beginning of the talk, part of our assumption is that the halakha, the halakhic enterprise on some level is broken. And it's not just broken because people outside of Orthodoxy are not keeping it. It's broken for much more fundamental reason. Specifically, and we've discussed this in the past and we'll discuss more of this in the future, the connection that we spoke about between halakha and religious consciousness is one that's been severed. In other words, whereas in the past halakha created contact points that would reinforce spirituality many times a day, for some reason, and there are many reasons, that process has been undermined. So that even within Orthodoxy, we have many people who are practicing, who are keeping the halakha often in very rigorous ways, who have almost no knowledge of spirituality, have almost no consciousness of God. I had a conversation, some of you have heard me speak about this before, but I think it's an important conversation, and a conversation that could be replicated many, many times. I was speaking with a man in his 60s of the old guard of the modern Orthodox Balei Batin. That is to say that his keeping of halakha was not extremely rigorous, to say the least. Very sloppy in all sorts of ways, in brachot, in the way they dress. And like many of the people of his generation, he had also gotten this particular case some sort of religious education, which is already unusual for that generation. But he sent his children to yeshivot, specifically to yeshiva university, and to spend a year or two in Israel after high school, and to yeshiva high school. And as a result, his children were much more rigorous in the practice of halakha. Right? They covered what they were supposed to cover, they made blessings when they were supposed to make blessings, and so on and so forth. And I asked him a question, and I thought I would get the answer that he gave me. I said, who do you think is more religious, you or your children? He didn't even have to think a second. He said, of course I'm more religious. And I think he's right. He had more of a connection with the Jewish people than his children. He had more of a connection with ethics than his children. And I would even say they had more of a connection with God than his children. Something's happened. And we've spoken about it in the past. I've had you read Chaim Soloveitchik's famous article on rupture and reconstruction, where he speaks about this problem, if you will. He doesn't treat it as a problem. He comes to it as a social scientist. But be that as it may, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik says that the very reason that people are striving to be more religious, in quotes, meaning they're more punctilious about halachic observance, is because they realize that they're less religious inside. And that being more religious outside is not meant to fix the problem inside, but rather to substitute for it. The last line of his article is particularly touching and quite sad. He says as follows: having lost the touch of God's presence, they seek now solace in the pressure of his yoke. Right, speaking about contemporary practice of younger generations, and younger generations I would imagine includes my own, I'll repeat what he said. Having lost the touch of God's presence, they seek now solace in the pressure of his yoke. So that this disconnect which we experience in our times between halakha on the one hand and spirituality on the other may threaten the very goals of the halakhic enterprise. Certainly the goal on the micro level of providing contact points to create consciousness is something that's not working. And therefore, at least on this point, I would say the halakhic enterprise is broken and presumably needs fixing. And even if you were to tell me that at least we have halakha as a social preservative, if people keep halakha, they're much less likely to assimilate, I would retort that how long can we keep on a national level a halakha that's divorced from its very essence, from the spirituality which is its very life? So I don't think we can find much solace in his yoke, at least on sociological terms, that all we have to do is rely on Shmirat HaMitzvot as we know it to maintain the identity of the Jewish people as we know it. That's by way of introduction. Why we're loyal to halakha, and the nature of the problem in our context, and the context of Orthodox Judaism. Obviously, the context is even broader, but I think within Orthodoxy, we meet the issue head on. Because we're the ones who are most concerned with halakha, we're the ones who feel that it has so much potential. We see its beauty. No one else is going to do anything to fix the halakhic system, because no one else cares about the halakhic system. And so the course is going to be divided into three components, and I'll set it up for you logically, as opposed to chronologically. Unfortunately, having mostly part-time people on our staff, and we take great pride in our staff, we take people who are busy, which is a good sign. If you're taking people who are not busy, it's not such a good sign. And therefore, much of our faculty is traveling all over the world at any given point in time, and creating a schedule with these people is something that would try anyone's patience. But be that as it may, the logical order of the course is as follows. We'll actually be starting at least with part of my unit, which is on the history of the halachic process. We'll only be starting this in December. I'll explain how that works a little bit later. But what I want to do with you, and I'll explain more when we meet again in December, is to explain the ideological contours of halakha, what halakha is trying to accomplish, and how its various particulars show us what it's trying to accomplish. And what happens when these particulars are not in line with what the halakha is trying to do. Speaking about historically, what happens when things change, when realia changes, when society changes? How has halakha developed? What were its stickling points? And what were areas in which it felt it had to transform and, for lack of a better word, evolve? We look into the variables that are involved in the halachic decision-making process on a macrocosmic level. Not so much. We'll obviously look at specific examples. We're going to look on the process as a whole from above. This is in order to give you some background as to what drives the halakha and the flexibility of halakha. Just looking at a book by Jacob Katz, some of you have heard of him, professor at Hebrew University of Medieval Jewish History, and also of Modern Jewish History, who subtitled one of his books, The Flexibility of Halakha. He, again, as a academic, he was an Orthodox Jew, but as an academic, in his introduction, he writes, the flexibility of halakha for some will mean that it's not serious, and for others will mean that it will survive. That's what Jacob Katz says in his book. The subtitle, I don't remember the title, I only remember the subtitle, Flexibility of Halakha. That caught my attention. But in any case, that's going to be the introductory section, at least on a logical level, to give you an idea of the flexibility of halakha. The next two sections being taught by Rabbi Cardozo and Rabbi Goshen Gottstein, chronologically in the opposite order, first Rabbi Goshen Gottstein, then Rabbi Cardozo, are both going to be attempts to deal with the problem that we've discussed. Given that the halachic system as we fulfill it today is broken, is not working on some level, what can be done about it? Rabbi Cardozo and Rabbi Goshen Gottstein will take very different approaches, not necessarily contradictory approaches, they can be complementary, but very different approaches, where Rabbi Cardozo is going to be looking at future directions of halakha, where the halakha can go, where in the ideal we would want to orchestrate it to go, and what's involved in that, what the price is, and what the rewards are. Rabbi Goshen Gottstein is going to be taking from a completely different perspective and looking at Rabbi Natan of Nimrod, who many of you know was the prime Talmud of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who wrote a book called the Likutei Halachot, Rabbi Natan did. And Rabbi Goshen Gottstein is going to use that book, or certain parts of the book, the large book obviously is only going to cover certain portions of it, is going to look at that book as a model of what can be done with halacha from an ideological, explanatory perspective, one that is meant to bring religious inspiration through the performance of halacha. And obviously, as I said, that's only going to be a model. Obviously, it has to be brought up to our own time. Of course, both directions that are going to be suggested come with risks. Anytime you suggest a new path, there's a possibility that you're going to make a mistake and find yourself lost. I would point out something that I've said in the past, that not taking risks is also a risk. And in our time, I would suggest it may be the biggest risk of all. That being said, and then Cardoza mentioned when he welcomed you, our task, our interest is not to convince you of anything, to have you agree with everything we say. Our task is merely to present new ideas to you. The Cardozo Academy is about creative thinking. It's about openness. It's about flexibility. And perhaps even more than anything else, it's about willingness to hear ideas that you disagree with. Because within the context of the Kotlei Beit HaMidrash, the walls of our Beit Midrash, we're going to hear, or we have heard, about Buddhism, about Christianity, about secular humanism, and so on and so forth. And we don't hope that you'll espouse every one of these isms, but we feel it's very important to be willing to hear. I mean really hear competitive ideas. Because without hearing competitive ideas, we won't really understand the depth of our own tradition. So, the bottom line of what we want to do in this class, and in others as well, is to create awareness of certain problems. In this case, a specific problem about the halachic system and the disconnect that I've spoken about. Even if you don't agree with us, and even if you disagree with everything that's been said through the whole year, I also want to make a caveat, at least about my portion of the class, but I think this will apply to the portions that will be given by Rabbi Goshen Gottstein and Rabbi Cardozo as well. By focusing on halacha this year, we're at somewhat of a disadvantage, or at least some of you will be at somewhat of a disadvantage. Our program in general is focused on the needs of future educational leaders, administrators, department chairmen, rabbis, outreach professionals, and so on and so forth. We know that not everybody is going to be involved in such things, but this is the center of our student body, and it's to them that we teach. And last year in that context, I spent much of the year decrying the near monopoly of halakha within our schools. When I say halakha, I'm speaking about halachic sections of the Gemara, that in any advanced, traditional advanced men's programs, and a growing number of women's programs as well, the vast majority of hours, 90, sometimes 95, sometimes even 100% of the curriculum has to do with Gemara, and specifically with halachic gemarot, what Rabbi Akiva was speaking about when he was speaking about Torah, the halachic enterprise. And I decried that because I think for the Jewish masses, for the people that were going to be educating, this is a disservice. It's not the most appropriate text, and it's not the most appropriate mode of how to teach in terms of what's needed out there. And anybody who's interested can speak to people who were here last year or otherwise try to get some of that information. And at the time, I argued that you people, educational leaders, need to immerse yourselves in other areas of study that we're less comfortable with. Be it Tanakh, be it Tefillah, be it Machshevet Yisrael, be it spirituality. We spoke about Parker Palmer last year. We spoke about non-Jews who are involved in plain and simple spirituality education. And I urge people, again, to find out and to immerse yourself in these areas of non-traditional study, both within and outside of Judaism. And what I was speaking about was very appropriate for our group here. There's a variety of backgrounds among our students. Everybody, I believe, brings a wealth, at least everyone I know, everyone who's applied and formally become a member of the student group, brings a wealth of Jewish education as well as secular education with them. But that education is uneven. Sometimes that's a good thing, that what one person doesn't know, another person can supplement, which is a very nice situation of cross-pollination. But by the same token, when we're speaking about halakha, certain people who are not familiar, have not spent many years of study within the halachic process, within traditional or even non-traditional Talmudic study of the first type, will be at a disadvantage. This is not the ideal. And people who are in that situation, some of you are and some of you are not, but some of you may not be able to evaluate properly some of the statements that are made within the context of this class. That's okay. Statements, one of the statements that I quote a lot, Blue Greenberg, who made a statement that if there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way, is an extremely difficult statement for anyone who's immersed in the halachic system. For someone who's not, sounds great. It seems like it's true. But for someone who understands halacha, it's extremely difficult to the point that one questions whether the person who made the statement has a serious background in the halachic system. By the way, as an aside, never speak about something about which you don't know anything about, or that you don't know enough about. It's a good way to get yourself into trouble. And it's very tempting, I'm sure we all do it, even within the confines of this prestigious academy, but it's a tremendous yetzer hara that one needs to avoid. So you might ask, if our audience, if our student body is of different backgrounds when it comes to halacha, why are we presenting this course at all? Maybe it belongs somewhere else. Maybe we should only take some of the students, the ones that have the background, and provide it as an elective for those students. The answer to that is that even those of you who are not going to follow rabbinic studies, I don't mean rabbinic as in getting a job, but traditional Gemara studies on an advanced level, or have not done so already, still need to know what's out there as possibilities. Especially if you are going to take on some leadership position. If you're not able to evaluate it, at least to know that it's out there. Because too many people don't even realize the possibilities. right or wrong, that's something that you may not be able to pass judgment on. But you do need to know that it's out there. At the same time, if you are in that situation, it's always important to realize that you're in that situation and that you're not in a position to pass judgment, but you are in a position to appreciate and to listen. At the same time, there are these people who come to our walls and will be involved in larger positions of leadership on a national level. I'm not speaking about being prime minister, though. You're all welcome to try. We could use some change around here. But it's not a political statement. The halls of Jewish national leadership are empty in terms of true leadership. It used to be that when some of the leadership, the great rabbis would say, you know, there are no gdolim left in our generation. They were speaking modestly. When the Chafetz Chaim said, and the Chafetz Chaim also is controversial from our perspective, but that he was a great person, no one can deny. When he would say there is no gdolim left in our generation, people knew that it was modesty. When people today say there are no gdolim left in our generation, people believe them, whether they're trying to be modest or not. The halls are empty. And we're trying to create leadership on that level also. Those people that come through our halls and have the abilities and have the desires and have the willingness to be moser nefesh, to sacrifice time, to sacrifice many things, to sacrifice financial gain. Those people who are interested in studying for many, many years in order to change the contours of halakha in our time need to come to a class like this. And if that means teaching people who may not get much out of the class, I think everyone will get a lot out of the class. But even if that's the price, I think it's a price that you would agree is worth paying. And for that person, it's not enough, or perhaps not even really important, to be a Talmid Chacham in the traditional sense of being able to become a Posek Halacha. Though again, like prime ministers, there's much need for good at Poskim in our time. What I'm speaking about, for someone who's serious about changing the course on a macro level of the contemporary contour of religious Judaism, which is really at the core of Judaism, it's the core of Jewish people, as we've argued all together, then it's important for you, if you have not done so already, to understand how the halakha works. If that means taking time off, then it's a price that your people will greatly appreciate. And whether, you know, it's men or women, whether it's someone who's had a religious education all your life, whether it's someone who's a Baal Tshuva and is more recent to the tradition, all of you are represented here. Someone who has the kelim, has the ability to make serious change, is encouraged to do what it takes. And what it takes is much more than just sitting in our classes, but I would suggest that it might be a good start. So, to recap, the idea of the class is that halakha is central to Jewish culture. So central that it accounts for our personal essence, our personal religious essence, and historically has connected us to spirituality in very positive ways, on the one hand. And on the other hand, has provided us with a strategy for national survival. And as such, it's something that if it's broken, you don't throw away. The first part of the course will be devoted to understanding, at least on a rudimentary level, how the system works. And then the second two parts, again, are from a logical order, will be dedicated to different possibilities in how to fix this tremendous and important problem to this most amazing system and most beautiful system that we've inherited.